For much of our history, circuses have been among the most popular forms of entertainment in this country. They brought exotic animals, acrobats, and freak shows to small, isolated towns. But when Ringling Brothers recently announced that they would retire their elephants in 2018, it underscored the dramatic changes now taking place in the American circus. For today's Please Explain, we will look into the history of the circus in this country and where this long tradition is headed. Joining me is Janet Davis, Professor of American Studies at University of Texas at Austin and the author of The Circus Age, Culture and Society Under the American Big Top. And we invite you, our listeners, to join in the conversation. Has anyone out there worked in a circus? Well, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Janet, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Haven't circuses been called a city within a zip code? Without a zip code, I mean. How large an operation are even the most modest ones?
Yes, absolutely. Circuses have been referred to as, you know, virtual cities in their own right because they have, you know, been these incredible traveling towns. And so you actually have a ton of variety in show size. There are shows that just have a few performers and a few workers attached to them over time, so-called smaller dog and pony shows, all the way up to the huge railroad shows, which had casts of over 1,000 people, hundreds of people working with the shows, hundreds of animals, and canvas big tops that could seat anywhere from 10 to 16,000 people. So there's been a lot of variety over the course of the history of the circus.
And the large circuses often have their own schools, cafes, convenience stores, laundries, and even pastors for church service.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. Show pastors have been a real central force in the history of these traveling towns, to be sure.
When was the first circus established in this country?
So the very first circus, we can say with some certainty, opens on April 3rd, 1793. And it opened in Philadelphia, and it was a very small operation by how we would consider a circus to look today. The person who ran the show was a Scotsman named John Bill Ricketts, and he was a trick rider. And his circus had a ring. It didn't have a roof, but an audience encircled that one ring. And he used horses from Pennsylvania. He had a small troupe of a rope walker, an acrobat, a clown, and he was riding his horse. And the kinds of things he might do, he would stand atop his horse, throw an orange in the air, and catch it on the tip of a sword. And so this first show was a sensation. President Washington went to the circus, and all sorts of important Philadelphians were there for this show.
And wasn't there another man named Philip Astley who had originally intended to make a riding school and then opened his own circus?
Yes, absolutely. So Astley has a really interesting North American connection, too. So Astley was actually, he founded his riding school in 1768 in London, and his first trick riding school was called the Halfpenny Hatch Riding School, and he noticed that people started flocking around just to watch people being trained, and so he thought, well, gee, you know, I've got a money-making opportunity here. So he started charging admission. But he has a really interesting connection to North America because he served in the King's Army during the Seven Years' War. So from, you know, roughly 1756 to 1763. So when he returned as a veteran, that's when he entered the trick riding business. And so his rival, Charles Hughes, was the teacher of John Bill Ricketts, who comes over to the New Republic. And actually, Ricketts comes over in 1792 to open a riding school in Philadelphia, but opens the first show that following year in April of 1793.
Were there circuses in Europe?
Yes, there were circuses in Europe. One of the things that's interesting, though, is that you have really the first kind of organization of all of these elements that we would consider to be part of modern circuses, like acrobatic riding, pantomime, clowning, rope dancing or wire walking, juggling, all of these elements had occurred earlier in the giant kind of fair tradition of Europe, medieval Europe, and then certainly into the Reformation era as well. And what happens is that Astley essentially reorganizes these elements to serve under this kind of circular arena encircled by an audience. So he's really the kind of father of the modern circus in London, and then it really just explodes from there.
Differentiating the circus from the carnival, in a sense.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And differentiating it also from troupes of, you know, essentially traveling shows where people would have individual skills that they would display.
Didn't some states like Connecticut and Vermont pass anti-circus laws sometime around not long after independence?
Yes.
Why?
Yes, there were. Yeah. So it's an interesting story because what you have going on here are shows that are relatively small in scale, but these are shows that are displaying scantily clad bodies, okay, engaging primarily with horses at this point and also athletic displays. And so these people who are performing with these circuses are, you know, women performed with these shows too. So think about this. You know, this is the turn of the 19th century. This is the era of evangelical revivalism in America, known as the Second Great Awakening. And a lot of ministers objected to people displaying their bodies for pay in front of audiences. And so this was something that, yes, indeed, certain places decided that, nope, they weren't letting the circus come to town. And the other thing that's interesting about this, too, is that this is an era of circus history in which shows made absolutely no attempt to market themselves to family audiences. They marketed themselves essentially as adult entertainment.
And a friend who grew up in Greece many years ago told me that when she was a kid, we're talking about maybe the 50s or 60s, she went to a small town circus that could only be described as raunchy. The American circuses probably wouldn't have done some of the things that she said she saw and was rather shocked by at a fairly early age.
Yeah. Well, there were certain things that happened, especially as the circus expands and you have other institutions like sideshows coming of age and cooch shows as well. But definitely, these shows tried to market themselves as being very respectable, to be sure. But yes, absolutely, things happened.
Now, you mentioned that clowns were there from fairly early. Is there one person who can be credited with being the first American clown?
That is an interesting kind of, you know, that's an interesting question because actually I think probably the most famous clown in American history is a clown by the name of Dan Rice. And he was a clown really in the Civil War era of the circus. But before that, there were several clowns that, you know, obviously many clowns performed, but I wouldn't say that we can really say that there's like a first clown. But I will say that clowns were really important in these early circuses because these were shows that were actually pretty intimate. They traveled, they stayed in one location for several months at a time, these very earliest circuses. And
were they under tents or were they did they have different kinds of buildings that they worked in?
Yeah, so they actually, the very earliest shows performed in semi-permanent buildings, some of which had roofs and some didn't. And oftentimes you would have people that showmen would disparagingly called knotholers who would crawl maybe if it had a roof and look inside peering down through knotholes or the sides of the walls, the wooden walls to look. And so these shows were in these kind of wooden buildings, and there was a lot of cost associated with constructing a show site at each of these places. And so showmen would stay at an individual show site for quite a long time. And it was relatively, these were small engagements, and clowns could be heard. They talked You know, they made jokes. They were ribald sometimes, and they talked about local politics. But what happens is that in 1825, an enterprising showman who was really, he's an American-born showman, too, which is also significant. His name was Joshua Purdy Brown, and he was from Somers, New York. And so the fact that he was born in America is significant because a lot of the really earliest showmen were European. And so now we're seeing the kind of growth of a different kind of uniquely American circus culture. And what Brown did in 1825 was he decided that it was time to start using canvas tents for his circus.
Was he influenced by the religious revivals that were often under tents?
He was actually, so this is a great question, because he was both inspired by that form of revivalism, but also the menageries, so these animal menagerie shows that showed under tents. But the religious revivals actually inspired him in quite a different way, because many of these communities that banned circuses, you know, that were part of these religious revivals, well, Brown came up with a kind of a neat solution to dealing with these bans. So just as an example, Wilmingham, Delaware was a town where its Quaker leadership decided that circuses could not show within the city proper. So what does Brown do? In November of 1825, November 22nd, he opens a pavilion circus right by a tavern outside the city limits. And so the pavilion circus pivoted nicely because he basically could draw audiences from Wilmington, but also, you know, essentially skirt these bans on shows. And so what happens with Brown's innovation of using these tents is that it establishes the rituals of itinerancy, one-day stops. And other showmen quickly copy Brown's kind of innovation. And even though there was less capital investment right up front in terms of you didn't have to build a building that could burn down, which they often did in the early days, but other costs were associated with these traveling shows, like horses, wagons, teamsters to drive the wagons, and then, of course, the canvas tents, which they actually adopted from sails, okay, you know, on ships. And so, interestingly, those costs made constant movement a necessity. So they established this kind of one-day stop system, and people in these frontier marketplaces were hungry for these kinds of entertainment. So they came to the show, and it was a very profitable, if risky, way to move.
So the cities didn't always want them, although there were plenty of circuses in cities, but these small towns welcomed them. We're talking about one-ring circuses, aren't we? When did the three-ring circus become a popular form of entertainment? Is it just the circuses that set up in the very big cities?
Well, what happens is all of these changes are also technological changes and infrastructural changes. So what happens when the big three-ring, two-stage, outer hippodrome track circuses come into existence? They come into existence because of the ways in which showmen adopt the railroad to their shows. So, as we know, the Transcontinental Railroad is finished in 1869. A showman actually took to the rails right after that from Omaha all the way to California, traveled overland a little bit, you know, off the rails, but made a ton of money. And so in 1872, P.T. Barnum, whom we all, you know about as this consummate showman, his partner, William Cameron Coop, in those days, he invented a flat car and wagon design which enabled laborers to roll fully loaded circus wagons on and off the railroad cars. And what that does is that it changes everything. Because even before that, some shows did try to travel by railroad in the antebellum era, but those shows were often thought of as really awful. It was an insult to be called a railroad show in those days because irregular track gauge, they had to carry the stock to the lot by hand. They often had fewer features than shows that traveled by wagon. So Coop and Barnum, what they do is they create the technologies necessary to make railroad travel easier. And so it changes everything, because what happens then is, with the kind of standardization of the American railroad infrastructure with the transcontinental railroads, what you have then is a mode of transportation that is relatively seamless and standardized. And so these shows explode in size. We see the circus as this icon of the Gilded Age, because the shows themselves get bigger. They haul more people. They have an enormous operations complex with advertising, advancement. Like, four cars would go out, four railroad cars, months in advance to plaster future markets with circus posters. And this huge labor force then was also responsible for setting up tents, tearing them down, caring for animals. And so this is when we see, in the early 1880s, we see the kind of proliferation of the three-ring circus. Becoming huge was a signature of the American circus.
There was also
really
the,
differentiated it.
There was also the parade through town that was a major part of the publicity.
Absolutely. And that actually is something that even started really early. A French circusman, Philippe Laison, he actually instituted the first American street parade as early as 1796. And so people were parading. But what you have going on in the age of these railroad circuses that really takes off, you know, with Barnum and Coop in 1872 and onward, is the parading becomes this kind of overwhelming show of the circus coming to town, and people referred in literature, court records, newspapers, they talked about Circus Day as this kind of singular event in which people would go to the show, awake before dawn, to see the show roll into town, watch the unloading and set up on a 9-acre lot. And the show itself was composed of all of these different layers of physically putting the show up, elephants helping in the process of setting up the tents, and then you have the giant parade. And schools canceled classes, factories closed. Businesses, actually, though, remained open, because there would be upwards of, say, 20,000 people coming into a smaller community, and they loved the extra business. And so this is this kind of singular ritual. And when people came to town for Circus Day, you have this kind of environment of volatility in which fights could occur, accidents, theft, any number of different events. So even the kind of spectacle of the crowd was another form of the show.
We're talking about circuses with Janet Davis, professor of American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin and author of The Circus Age, Culture and Society Under the American Big Top. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we will continue a conversation after this. And we are back with Janet Davis. Her book, The Circus Age, Culture and Society Under the American Big Top. And we are talking about circuses on today's Please Explain. And we mentioned clowns before. It's been my sense that the look of clowns has been changing over my lifetime. What were clowns like originally?
So there were different clowning traditions that really were on display in the, you know, in the earlier days, and both of which actually still you see elements of them today. But you had the kind of traditional white face clown, you know, with the self-described white face and then a signature look. But you also had the august clown, who might have a slightly different, maybe kind of, you know, more impish cast. So a clown who might dress in, say, in the 1930s with Emmett Kelly as a tramp, or a clown who's more of a kind of Oh, golly. You know, just someone who's actually there to make mischief. And actually, both clowning traditions would do that, too. But the thing that's interesting about clowns is that in the era of the small shows, the more intimate circuses, as I mentioned, the talking clown was an important kind of conduit to local communities because these clowns oftentimes had, you know, they had multiple language skills, and so given the kind of culturally pluralistic communities that they were coming to in America, they might read newspapers in several different languages, and they would make jokes accordingly, talking about local politics. So what happens with the rise of these big three-ring circuses is that the talking clown really becomes a thing of the past in these very large shows. They still talked in the very small shows, but in the big shows, they essentially become an element of coordination. So just as an example, if they if there was an accident in the show, you know, if someone fell or something happened, send in the clowns. They're going to distract the audience while everything is taken care of.
Has anybody done this? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, and what I was also just going to mention is the fact that most of their movement and their joking essentially became a form of pantomime because they couldn't be heard any longer in a big top that could seat 10,000 people. And so they're kind of this element of coordination, but they also become a kind of job, if you will, for people who became maybe disabled as riders or aerialists, you know, other kinds of labor, on performance labor on the show. When people couldn't do those kinds of jobs anymore, men especially, there were only a few women in the, you know, in the late 19th century, but they would, you know, sometimes these guys would turn to clowning because it typically was less physically taxing, although there were certainly clowns who were very athletic as well.
Has anyone done a study about why small children are often frightened by clowns?
Well, you know, it's an interesting, yeah, I've been long kind of bedeviled by that as well. And honestly, I think there has been research. I mean, it actually has an official name whose name I can't remember at the moment. But in any case, I know for one that when John Wayne Gacy, the serial killer in Chicagoland, you know, he dressed up as a clown. And so there is this definite, you know, and this is in the later 20th century, but definitely the fact that he wore the kind of clowning mask to hide a kind of demonic character. I know that, you know, among actual clowns, that was a very disturbing turn because, for sure.
Let's take a call from Jim from Danville, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. First time, long time. I love your show.
Go ahead.
My dad and his cousin for many years were members of a group called the Circus Saints and Sinners. They ran a couple of big fundraisers every year, and the purpose was to support retired circus performers. Their particular club was based out of Paterson, New Jersey, and was called the Lou Costello Tent. They would run big dinners, 300, 400, 500 men at a time would come in. They would start with exotic dancers out in the bar lobby area, and then have a roast with local sports or celebrities, Mickey Mantle, Jim Jensen, the old host of CBS News, and other people like that. I'm wondering if your guest has ever heard of these people, the Circus Saints and Sinners.
Oh, my goodness, that's fantastic. I have. I wish I knew more because I would love to. Oh, my gosh, I love this. But the Circus Saints and Sinners is really part of a proud tradition of you know, essentially people supporting each other in this business. There was a showman's league in the early 20th century who actually really, you know, was very helpful to injured performers who would help, you know, pay for costs, and in the tragic instance when someone would pass away, would help pay for funeral costs. And one person in particular who comes to mind that, you know, really evokes in some ways what Circus Saints and Sinners is doing, you know, in a more contemporary sense, is this very beautifully kind of talented rider named Otto Klein. He was a trick rider, and he was very tragically, he was killed during a performance at Madison Square Garden in April of 1915. And his widow, Tiny Klein, who became a big circus performer in her own right, hanging by her teeth, ziplining across Times Square in the early 30s. But when Otto passed away, the initial gravestone was, you know, very modest, but people, this Showman's League actually sponsored the construction of a really beautiful memorial for Otto, and you can see it today in Naperville, Illinois. You know, and that's just an example of how this is a community that, you know, is very much aware of the kinds of, you know, that this can be a difficult and thrilling but unpredictable life.
Now, we mentioned earlier that the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey said they're going to ease out the use of elephants. But when did exotic animals like bears, camels, elephants, lions, and tigers begin being used in circuses? Was it around the same time that zoos were being created in this country?
Yeah, so the arrival of these exotic animals in circuses is something that happens in a kind of piecemeal fashion at first. So you have, for example, individual animals being taken to America during the colonial era by enterprising ship captains who would often then sell the animals to people who would exhibit them as individuals near tavern yards, often traveling under cover of darkness to prevent people from looking, you know, getting a free look. So you have the first lion in 1716, the first camel in 1721, the first polar bear in 1733, and the first leopard in 1768. And then the first elephant, the crown and shield elephant, brought over to the United States from India by the ship Captain Jacob Crown and Shield in 1796. But these were initially animals who were displayed either alone or in menageries that traveled. And so these traveling menageries were initially apart from the actual circus.
But I remember what going happened? To a circus yeah. at Madison Square Garden when I was a kid, and under this was downstairs under the rings, there were animals, and there was also something of a freak show. That has all pretty much disappeared. And is that partly because of the influence of the animal rights groups?
It is. I mean, I would say that the animal rights movement has had definitely a very strong influence on the kind of current shape of the circus. And it's interesting because in the early days, the circus actually came to incorporate animals into its fold. In 1828 is when it first starts. Again, that showman, Joshua Purdy Brown, the canvas tent guy, he creates an animal menagerie at his circus. And the reason he did this was to essentially to make more money, first of all, but also to make a show of the fact that his circus was educational. It offered a kind of edifying look at the world through its animals. And so kind of pushing back on clergymen's claims during the Second Great Awakening that these shows were sites of ill repute. And he could say, no, 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 we are a respectable institution. And so really from that point on is when you see these animal menageries being part of the circus.
Let's take another call. This is from Kate from Hudson Valley, New York. Hi, Kate.
Oh, hi. I saw a circus in Bombay, India, in 1967, and it had...
Hello? Oh,
hello?
Yeah.
Hi.
Are you not hearing her? She said she saw a circus in Bombay, India, in 1967. It had...
Great.
It had a rhinoceros?
No, a hippopotamus. A small, delicate, pink, graceful, dancing hippopotamus. And I have also seen a circus, like, in Madison Square Gardens, not about 1947 with Emmett Kelly. But what struck me about the Indian circus is it was only one ring, and it was in a tent out by the airport on the edge of town.
Now, what about those circuses? Circuses in other parts of the world, were they influenced by American circuses? There's a long tradition in India.
Definitely, yes. Oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned your experiences in Bombay.
And we have very little time, Janet.
Okay, yes, absolutely. Circus is a global tradition, first and foremost. You have circus traditions that really that they are happening all over the world, really, through the millennia, essentially, because of this kind of entangled relationship between people and animals and doing tricks. And so you see this kind of transnational influence among circuses around the world. And so both influenced by the United States, but also influencing the United States.
And a circus today probably has a lot of foreign acts.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. And it has been an international popular form since its origins in the United States.
Now, a listener also points out that there were clowns before circuses because Shakespeare includes them and refers to them in his plays.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And their court jesters are absolutely part of a clowning tradition as well. So these are all kind of iterations of these other institutions that all come together in this circular cultural form.
We have about 10 seconds, but where do you see circuses heading? They're not as popular as they used to be.
Well, there's an interesting thing. I think in some ways circus arts, the individual elements of circus, are absolutely more popular than ever in terms of physical culture and live entertainment in a very mass-mediated age. But definitely it is changing form just as it has done since its origin.
Janice Davis, whose book, The Circus Age, Culture and Society Under the American Big Top, is what we've been talking about on today's Please Explain. Thank you so much.